Good morning, or as Karen will tell me in a moment, good evening.
Good evening.
Is John Richardson speaking with you from Toronto, Canada. Today is Monday, October the 25th, 2021, and it is 7:50 a.m. my time, emphasizing this is the morning. And today I have the great pleasure of speaking with Dr. Karen Alpert in Australia, who probably will tell me in 1 second that it's the evening there. Is that correct, Karen?
That's right. It's almost 10 p.m. here.
But at least we're doing this on the same day, October the 25th, somewhere in the world. And for those of you who are interested in the whole issue of citizenship taxation and the tax treaties, Karen, as many of you will know, among her many accomplishments, is the founder of the FixTheTaxTreaty.org site and the Facebook group FixTheTaxTreaty.org, which was formed with a view to pointing out how the Australia-US tax treaty, and by implication treaties in other countries as well, exacerbates the harm of the US citizenship taxation regime. And interestingly, Australia has recently sent out sort of a basic call out for people's views on tax treaty updates in general, I think, and that would include the US tax treaty. And surprise, surprise, Dr. Karen Alpert has a few things to say about that and suggestions. So welcome, Karen. How are you today?
Hi, John. Yeah, I'm glad to be here. Thanks.
So Karen.
Yes. The Australian Treasury sent out a consultation because they want to expand and update Australia's tax treaty network. Now, you know, to be honest, I think they were looking at what countries does Australia not have a tax treaty with that we should have a tax treaty with. But they did say update, so I have to take them at their word. And if there's one treaty that needs updating, it's the treaty with the United States. We've got a new military alliance with the U.S. the AUKUS treaty. It's time to fix up the tax treaty so that we can. I really see the current treaty as stifling labor mobility and the ability to move freely between two countries that are very good friends, right?
Well, it's interesting to me that you talk about updating the tax treaty and in the next sentence, updating a military treaty. And I mean, Karen, do you think that the U.S. tax treaties are fundamentally an act of war and aggression against other countries?
Look, I don't think it's the treaties that's the act of aggression. I think it's citizenship taxation that is. And I think that most countries, when they agree to let the U.S. tax citizens by including a saving clause in the treaty, I don't think they really understand what they're doing. I don't think they understand that they're allowing the U.S. to come in and steal from their own tax base.
Well, let's break that down a little bit, because that certainly is a mouthful, but. You and I think, would agree that citizenship taxation is probably would it be the original sin?
Absolutely.
Okay. And so what citizenship taxation really means is that the U.S. is claiming the right to claim the tax residence of other countries as their own tax residence. Would that be accurate?
That's right. The U.S. is claiming the right to tax someone based on their citizenship and not their residence. So someone who's living in Australia who is a U.S. citizen, the U.S. is claiming the right to tax them on their worldwide income, including their Australian income. So any income that the Australian government decides to provide a concessional tax rate for or not tax at all to further Australian domestic policy, the U.S. takes it away.
Now, that sounds very, very similar to a discussion I was having with somebody a few days about the whole GILTI regime. I mean, you know, boy, if the other country doesn't tax, then it must be there, left there specifically for us to tax, right? A gift
exactly.
To the U.S. Treasury, is that what it is?
Essentially, yeah.
I mean, these people basically.
I think, I think this frustrates domestic policy in Australia.
Well, it certainly does. I mean, if somebody, I think as is the case in Canada, there's the domestic policy in Australia, for example, is the principal residence should not be subject to taxation, the capital gain, right?
Right, right.
And for that's residence. Important, I guess, because, you know, people need a place to live, and I guess they ought to be able to sell their house and buy another one with right. that money, you know, these sorts of notions. But, you know, that's a very un-American idea, isn't it? You know, the idea that you ought to be able to sell your house and keep the money and use it to buy another house. But right. that's a clear example of how clearly U.S. citizenship-based taxation would frustrate Australian domestic policy. And there are others. I'm sure that we'll talk a little bit about the whole superannuation thing. But
exactly.
So what we have with this tax treaty is, I mean, let's separate the discussion into things that are specific to Australia that we'll get to in a second and things that are common right across the board. But let's begin with what's common right across the board. And, you know, it's the savings clause thing, right? That's common to all these U.S. tax treaties.
So exactly.
Could you help us by starting with that? What is this damn saving clause thing? Is it to save Australians from the United States?
No, it's to save the U.S. government. So basically, most tax treaties, they'll have, they'll apply to residents of either country, and then they'll tell you what each country can tax. And then, but in order to figure out what benefits you get from the country, from the treaty, you need to know which country you're a resident of. And so there's usually a residence tiebreaker in there that says, okay, you're going to be a resident of one of these countries and only one for tax purposes. American citizens look at that and say, great, I'd love to do that. But there's that saving clause. The saving clause says, oh, wait a minute. If you're a US citizen, forget the treaty exists, because you can't use any of the benefits in the treaty, certainly not the residence tiebreaker, and basically nothing else unless we specifically list that you can use it. And there's a couple of things that they list, like Social Security generally, that whatever the Social Security treatment is, they'll list that. If they're a retirement account, provisions, the modern ones, those are generally exempt from the saving clause. But it's a really small list of things that are exempt from the saving clause.
Karen, do you think that, you know, you call it the saving clause and it's something that nobody understands. So, you know, they just kind of gloss over. Maybe it would be better, should it be called the Hotel California clause?
that's a good name for it. It's the Let's Preserve Citizenship-Based Taxation clause.
Actually, isn't it far worse? Let's export it. In other words, yeah. By signing one of these tax treaties, basically with a savings clause, all these governments have invited the United States to come in, claim all their tax residents as U.S. tax residents, and essentially use them to siphon money out of the country. Is that an accurate statement?
Exactly.
Well, how come nobody explains it this way then? What's going on here?
Well, the what's going on is the U.S. has the power to say, we're not signing the treaty unless you put this in. And everybody wants the treaty, and businesses want the treaty. And the saving clause affects individuals. And individuals are really not hardly considered at all when they're negotiating a tax treaty.
Well, I think that is probably right. I mean, maybe going forward, it makes sense in the world. I'll tell you something that I found very interesting. In the final days of the Trump administration, I think his name is it Robert Lighthizer? Is that, am I pronouncing it correctly? The,
I don't know.
The Trump trade representative. Well,
yeah.
You know, what happened was, as you're presumably aware, that there's this, discussion of digital services tax and things like that going on generally mm-hmm. in the world. And in June of, I think, 2020, the U.S. pulled out of those discussions. Now, Robert Lighthizer made a very interesting comment where he said that it really is time to rethink the rules of international taxation. who is taxed and how, et cetera. And I, although he may not have intended it, certainly his language was broad enough to include individuals. And I'm wondering, do you think it would make sense for treaties to have essentially two parts, part A dealing with entities, that is corporations, et cetera, part B dealing with individuals?
I think there need to be special provisions in there to make sure that, that individuals are not left out. I think some of the provisions work, you know, like a the dividend articles work fine for individuals versus corporations, but we need to have retirements, savings articles, which most treaties don't have, not adequate anyways. They might talk about a pension, but we're well beyond the time when most people get a pension from anything. Everybody's using retirement savings plans, right? It's like a 401k type plan where you put money in and it's a defined contribution. And defined contribution plans aren't really covered by most treaties. There's a few out there that do, but most of the older ones don't.
Well, or the consensus is the older ones cannot be interpreted to include sort of things that are analogous to 401ks as pensions, I think, right? Would that be a better way of putting it?
Yeah, I mean, I think some of them are anyways, but only with the on the withdrawal side, not on the accumulation side.
Okay.
Very few treaties have anything about the accumulation.
Okay, let's just pause for 1 second, okay? And let's just do a summary of, you know, what we've talked about here in the treaties in a couple sentences, and then let's sort of transition and apply this to Australia. So basically, I think I've got this right in saying that in the beginning, the original sin is U.S. citizenship-based taxation. In other words, the U.S. rule imposing worldwide taxation according to U.S. tax rules on any U.S. citizen, regardless of where they live and whether they are or are not also a tax resident of another country. So far, so good?
Mm-hmm.
Two, so a U.S. citizen moves to a place like Australia or Canada or whatever, and that person does not escape U.S., at least what the Internal Revenue Code says, they're still subject to these U.S. tax rules, correct?
Right.
Three, the problem is very much exacerbated because when the U.S. enters into tax treaties with other countries, it includes what you call the saving clause, but I think I'm going to adopt, I'm going to call it the Hotel California clause from here on, okay?
Okay.
You know, this idea that by signing on to this, Australia, Canada, the UK, they're all actually agreeing, they're shaking the hand of the United States and saying, yes, by God, U.S. citizens cannot have the benefit of this treaty, and yes, we fully agree that you can impose worldwide taxation on our citizens, or residents that also happen to be U.S. citizens. Agreed?
All right.
And,
you know, in Australia, more than half of the U.S. citizens living in Australia are also Australian citizens.
Now, that is amazing stuff, isn't it? So, in other words, being an Australian citizen cannot protect you from the disability of being a U.S. citizen. Is that
That's fair? Right. That's right.
Unbelievable.
And right, now, yet they still talk about these as Americans living in Australia rather than Australians who are subject to U.S. taxes.
I mean, what does it take for an American to become an Australian? What do they have to do?
They have to renounce their citizenship. Their U.S. citizenship.
Are there people actually doing that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. If they can get an appointment. I know several people who are unable to get appointments at the moment. I'm sure there are thousands of them.
Oh my God, I had no idea people were actually renouncing. Okay, yeah. Now, so let's take the general principle. And for part two here, could you just give me a synopsis of some practical difficulties of American or dual citizens, okay, living in Australia? What is it they cannot do or the problems they have? Because of this.
So in our submission to Treasury, I've got four recommendations. One is on the savings costs, which we've already covered. The other three are sale of the personal residence. So if you sell your personal residence, you're an Australian resident living in Australia. Australia doesn't tax it. So the US swoops in and says, okay, I'll tax that. And so we're proposing that Australia suggests that in any real estate transaction of Australian real estate by an Australian resident should be taxable only by Australia. And the US should not have any ability to tax.
Now, this is really interesting. Now, so I'm understanding that what you're saying is that you want a specific provision in the treaty that says this?
I want a specific provision in the treaty that says that if a resident of one country sells real property in that country, that the other country has no ability to tax that. And that should be exempted from the saving clause if it exists.
All right. So in the language of tax treaties, that would give the exclusive right of taxation to one country.
To the resident country, to the country where you're physically resident.
Now that's really, really good stuff. Really, really good stuff. The exclusive right of taxation. So that would allow, so let's say that were implemented, that would allow Australia, if it wanted to impose a taxation on the sale of a principal residence. In other words, it doesn't hinder Australia, but it simply prevents the US from doing it. That's a great idea. Great idea. Now tell me another problem of American.
So the biggest problem people have is their retirement savings. So in Australia, employers are mandated to put, I think it's just gone up to 10% of salary into a superannuation account. That 10% is not taxable to the individual. It's taxed at 15% when it gets into the superannuation account. Any income inside of it, inside the superannuation account, is taxed at 15%. And then if you're over age 60 when you withdraw, there's no tax on withdrawal. So this is very different from a US 401k because there is tax on the income as you're going along. But at a concessional rate. So for the US citizen who's living in Australia and receiving this, first of all, it's just not clear. It's not clear what the US tax treatment is because obviously the US Internal Revenue Code didn't even think about superannuation. I mean, Congress didn't legislate this is how you're gonna tax superannuation because that's not on their radar, right? So the IRS and tax practitioners have to interpret the rules that are aimed at US structures to figure out how they apply to these Australian structures. And the rough consensus, but there's no IRS ruling and there are lots of different opinions and lots of different ways of organizing your superannuation account that will change the tax treatment. But for most employees who are contributing to the employer plan,
one that's not self-managed, correct?
Right, one that's not self-managed, and so their U.S. tax preparer will generally add those superannuation contributions to their U.S. taxable income, mm-hmm. so that they're being taxed on those as they go in, and then that gives them like a cost basis essentially.
But
the growth gets taxed when you withdraw.
Okay. So yeah, so let's just break this down a little bit here, okay.
John, the problems are a difference in timing and a difference in which entity is paying the tax. So because you're not personally paying the tax, you may not, because it's being paid inside the superannuation fund, you're not going to get a credit for any tax paid in Australia on your superannuation. So you're guaranteed to be double taxed because of that. Mm-hmm. And so that's one problem. Another problem is a timing problem. because Australia doesn't charge tax on the income going in. Well, it does at 15%, but it's lower than the normal rate. And it does that inside the super fund. And Australia doesn't tax it on the way out. So when you receive your payouts on the way out, most likely your Australian tax is zero. Your Australian taxable income may very well be zero if all of your income is coming out of your superannuation fund. But the U.S. is treating it as taxable income.
So Karen, I am guessing that your proposal for the tax treaty update might include Australia has the exclusive right to tax superannuations.
Certainly for Australian residents.
For Australian residents. Okay.
For Australian residents. There is a problem, though, of Australians who move to the U.S. and work and they've got superannuation. So the treaty needs to cover that situation as well.
Well, it seems to me on that point that there ought to be some sort of international treaty on, you know, for pension mobility.
Right.
There ought to be.
The whole thing is insane. I know some people will disagree with this, but I think the answer is that the source country should have exclusive taxing rights because the money was earned in that country.
I agree with you.
And it's just been deferred.
Yeah, I agree with you.
And it's just been deferred. So
why would anybody disagree with that? I mean, you know, what is interesting, Karen, is that is not the presumptive rule under most tax treaties, including
the OECD. No, exactly. It's not.
Let's just talk about that as a bit of an aside for a second. So I'm interested in your comments here.
So a lot of people look at tax as, you know, we're taxing worldwide income because the resident country they've got the worldwide income. They know what you can afford to pay in tax. In other words, they have an idea of, that the tax burden is not going to be too much or too little. They know what your worldwide income is, and they can provide a fair level of tax. That's one theory, or that's one argument for having the resident country tax the retirement flows. But I think my argument is basically based on, you know, the source of the income. The source of the income is the country where you earned, you know, and put it away.
Well, the
advantage of that is that you're then using the same tax rules that you saved under. So when you put your money in the savings, you know what the result is going to be. So if we're not going to be doing it source country, we need to have a treaty that's so that people know when they put their money in the savings, they know what the result's going to be. Because if you're saving for 30 years, you don't want to find out in 25 years that, oh no, it's going to be a lot more tax than I expected.
Yeah, I think that part of the argument for that is, and I think it's a good argument, is that it provides certainty. But I think there's a second point here as well that, you know, these retirement savings plans, the source country gives up rights for present taxation, right?
Right, exactly.
I think there's an argument sort of in fairness to the source country as well. But, you know, Karen, all these problems of international tax, right, arise because of conflicts between residents and source, right? I mean, why not just move the whole world to source taxation? All these problems would go away. But anyway, so obviously, the whole superannuation thing, which is well known to anybody who's experienced this, is a major, major difficulty. And that needs clarification in the treaty. Okay. And I think, your proposal, which I'm understanding to be that for Australian residents, Australia has the exclusive right to tax the super,
right.
Correct. Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, exactly. Great. I think that makes total sense. Okay.
Yeah. And the third area is investments. So outside of your retirement account, you know, when I was teaching finance at university, my advice to students was, if you want to minimize your risk and maximize your return, you want to be broadly diversified, go buy an index fund, right? And especially if you're just, you know, starting out and you only have, you know, a 10,000 or less, 2,500 to invest, the only way you're going to get diversification with that amount of money is through an index fund or some sort of managed structure, right? Problem for US citizens though, is that if they buy non-US managed funds, their tax preparer is going to say, ooh, it's a passive foreign investment company. We're going to tax that punitively.
A what? What did you just say?
A passive foreign investment company, right?
What in God's name is that?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I think a lot of people just assume that all of these things are passive foreign investment companies or PFICs, right? But I think if you looked closely at some of them, you'd find that they really weren't. They were, they're trusts, not companies, some of them, etc. But all tax preparers are treating them all as passive foreign investment companies, applying punitive taxation to them. And so the answer then is, if you're a US citizen living in Australia, is, oh, well, I'll have to buy my index fund in the US. And I'll have to move all my investment.
And that presumably sets up difficulties on the Australian side.
It sets up some difficulties on the Australian side, yes. They're not as, that not nearly as hot as punitive as the US rules. But it also sets up the difficulty, how do I open an account where I'm, where I can invest in a US fund?
Yeah. Karen,
you know, which
do
is
you
difficult.
Think that what I'm getting from this is, all right, I mean, these are all great examples, but I think a general theme, which is the U.S. has stopped harassing tax residents of other countries. Is that the message?
Certainly, but we're providing comments to the Australian government about what the Australian government should put in the tax treaty to avoid this problem. So our proposal was that we put a clause in the tax treaty that says that let me read exactly what I wrote because I had it written pretty well, I thought.
I'm sure.
Yeah, a non-discrimination article, or add to the non-discrimination article, a clause that prohibits discrimination against investments available to retail investors in the other country. So if U.S. taxpayers invest in Australia, the U.S. is not allowed to discriminate against Australian retail investments. So they can't, which means they can't apply the PFIC rules, because that's discrimination against Australian relative to their domestic, U.S. domestic. They have to tax the Australian funds just as if it were a U.S. domestic fund.
Okay, great idea for sure. I wonder if the discrimination clause is the right place to put that. But anyway, that's great. Okay, so certainly the this whole PFIC thing is beyond ridiculous. And
yeah,
for listeners, in addition to the punitive tax consequences, the reporting requirements are absolutely horrific. And probably cannot be managed without, some kind of specialized tax preparation.
Well, and the form, that what, 8261?
8621, yeah.
8621, yeah. What does the IRS say? It takes, what, 24 hours to prepare?
Actually, that demonstrates that they don't understand it either, because the truth is it does not take that length of time.
No.
To prepare that form. It also tells you that, when they're talking about 24 or 35, whatever it was, this exorbitant number of hours, it tells you that they understand the purpose of these rules to be primarily aimed at resident Americans who own interests in foreign corporations that don't meet the threshold of being a CFC.
Yeah.
That's what I think was really the original intent of this. But the problem is that once this gets into the hands of tax preparers who are defensively minded, they sort of, create their own view of this.
So these were put into the tax code in 86, is that right?
86.
Yeah. And so in 86, yes, managed in funds, you know, mutual funds existed, but they were not being used by everybody the way they are now. They are now the way everybody invests, aren't they? I mean,
you know, absolutely. Because, you know, when I think of my own life, in the early 80s, I remember opening a brokerage account at what I think was then called Merrill Lynch. I don't even know if that still exists. Mm-hmm. But, and what I remember was that the person was trying to sell me a mutual fund. I think it was actually specifically Templeton Mutual Fund. And about the same time, a class, I think I just sort of basically gotten out of university, whatever, but a classmate of mine started selling mutual funds for some other company and was trying to sell me mutual funds as well. But what I remember is that the cost to get into these funds was like 7 or 8%.
Yeah.
So, I mean, leaving aside the
You get John Bogle out there getting, you know, putting together his Vanguard funds.
Yeah, you know, the ETF. But I think the cost of getting into a mutual fund at the time the PFIC rules were enacted is further evidence that mutual funds could not have been on the radar for the simple reason that most people couldn't afford to use them anyway.
Right.
I mean, at that time, they were elite investment vehicles, right? I mean, you want to invest under the supervision of Sir John Templeton, by God, you had to pay.
Yeah.
You know, this sort of thing. And we have a complete reversal now. But in any case, there is no question that the world of investing for most middle class people is now mutual funds, ETFs, et cetera.
Right. And so therefore, what the PFIC rules do is they discriminate against the middle class.
But the whole tax code discriminates against the middle class.
Because the wealthy can manage to diversify, you know, direct shares, which wouldn't be a problem. They can afford to get somebody to manage a direct portfolio for them if they're not able to do it themselves. But you've got to have $250,000 before you start doing a direct share portfolio, or you can't diversify.
Well, not only that, but you have to think about what to invest in. You know, which is another problem as well.
So you can mirror an index fund with $250,000.
Yeah. Okay.
You don't have to think about what you're doing, really. You just
Thank God for that.
You can replicate an index fund, but you got to have at least $250,000, I think, to get enough in each to make the transaction costs worthwhile.
Right. Okay. So bottom line, though, all right, this is another example where, you know, this really is turning the U.S. citizenship thing into a disability. I mean, it's incredibly difficult to manage retirement and financial planning for an American outside the United States. And, or rather, why don't I put it in the context of your group? It's incredibly difficult for an Australian citizen resident who just happens to have been born in the United States.
Well, or whose parents were born in the U.S.
Well, that's right. The sins of the father. The sins of the father.
Exactly. Yeah. Or you know, anyways, there's lots of ways you can end up being a U.S. citizen that,
don't necessarily mean
you have a very large or great connection to the United States.
Yeah. I remember when Obama was president, as press secretary, I think it was Jay Carney, said, you know, the president believes that the circumstances of your birth should not determine the outcome of your life. But, you know, for Americans, it's even worse. It's the circumstances of the parents' birth can determine the outcome of your life.
Yeah,
this is just the American way, Karen.
Absolutely. Anyway, so we've put together this this consultation or this submission to the Australian Treasury. which you can find on our website, which is fixthetaxtreaty.org. And for those Australians listening, I'd like to encourage you to submit your own submission to Treasury. All the links and everything are on the website. You can attach ours, or you can just pull out of it what the proposals that you think are particularly relevant to you. And submission deadline is the 31st of October. So you have a week to put this together.
You know, Karen, you've done this fantastic heavy lifting, and it really is. I read your submission this morning. This is just like, it is absolutely first rate, second to none. You should get an A++++ for this. I mean, you know, you've done, but that's what I would expect from you over the years. Okay. And now that you're retired, you have even more time for excellence in these submissions, right? But here's what I would suggest for individuals. I would not try to recreate the wheel here. I mean, Karen's definitely got that. What I would suggest is that you explain the hardship in your own life living in Australia because of these rules.
Or even for Australians living in the US who are affected by the treaty, you don't have to be currently living in Australia to make a submission. It's all by email. And if you're an Australian living in the US who's having trouble because of your superannuation, that's the main problem that Australians in the US are having, this is your chance to let your voice be heard.
Absolutely. And these chances do not come along all that often, right?
Right.
All right. Boy, I bet you the government of Australia is going to rue the day that they solicited public input into this. In fact, they may pass a law. They're going to call it the Prevent Karen Alpert Law.
I doubt it. I doubt it.
Drawing attention to these things. Anyway, as always, you know, totally fantastic work that you have. Continue, and I hope you will do in the future. This is great. So for listeners, if you go to fixthetaxtreaty.org, it is the top post right now, and I would suggest it stay the top post till after October the 31st. And there's instructions for how to make your own submission, and certainly I would encourage you to do so. All right. Well, this has been great. Thanks for spending part of your evening discussing this, Karen. Do you have any closing comments that you'd like to offer up here? Or shall we just close with go to fixthetaxtreaty.org? That's where it's happening.
Yeah, well, like John said, that these opportunities don't come up very often. This is your time, the time for you to make your voice heard. So please, I hope plenty of people make submissions.
Yes, absolutely. And thank you so much for your continuing work on this. I mean, Karen, you made just a major, major contribution to this whole discussion over the years. Yeah, thank you for that. Okay. We'll stop here. Remember, fixthetaxtreaty.org. That's where it's happening.